The Nightingale Cornet Corporation is pleased to present Negotiating Strategies and Tactics, an effective manager seminar with Brian Tracy.
Your success in business and your success in life may be determined by your ability to negotiate in your best interest. In fact, negotiating is a life process that affects everything that you do, everything that you say, almost all of your interactions with others, both personally, in business, socially, in a variety of other ways. And if you cannot negotiate well in your best interest, if you cannot negotiate on your behalf, then what you do is you become the victim of people who can negotiate well on their behalves. Now, I have a lot of experience in negotiating. Let me just take a second to tell you. I've been buying and selling and negotiating products and services and deals now for over 25 years. I have bought, sold, negotiated the selling, the leasing, the purchase, the development of something like $100 million worth of real estate. I have negotiated the importation, distribution, and setting up of the dealerships and sales of over $25 million worth of automobiles. I've negotiated printing contracts, I've negotiated consulting contracts, I've negotiated real estate development and land development contracts, I have negotiated the sale of a variety of different goods and services, including convention services, hotel services, training services, and so on. So I know an awful lot about negotiating, but I've also studied the subject for years. And in the next few minutes, what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to give you 21 of the most important ideas that I have learned in the field of negotiating that you can use starting right now to get better deals for yourself and better deals for your company and your organization. Basically, everybody wants the same things, and in different orders of priority. They want security, they want comfort, they want leisure, they want love, they want respect, and they want fulfillment. We begin to negotiate from the time we are infants. In fact, even little infants, I have a one-year-old son, even little children know that hugs and affection are the currency with which they negotiate with their parents and with other people. In fact, negotiating or not negotiating, compromising, trying to bring together conflicting interests is an essential part of human life. You and I are different. Every human being values different things in different ways. All values are subjective. When we say a subjective evaluation, it means that the only reason that we trade is because you have something that I want more and I have something that you want more, and as a result, we try to find a satisfactory way to, if you like, compromise and modify and adjust our different interests. So let's talk about negotiating. Let's talk about the 21 keys. A key point is that negotiating is a skill, that you can learn it as a skill. You can become better at it. The more you work at it, the more you understand the process, the more you think it through, the better you become, and the better a negotiator you are, the happier you will be, the more self-confident you will be, the more self-reliant, the more in control of your destiny you will be to the degree to which you can negotiate in your best interest. Principle number one with regard to buying and selling in the marketplace is that everything is negotiable. Everything is negotiable. Now, this is a key point, and you have to keep remembering that no matter what it looks like on the outside, everything is negotiable. One of the perfect examples of this is that people will print a price list, or they'll write out a price, or they'll put a price tag on a product or service, and they'll present it to you, and they say, here's the price. But the fact is that that price doesn't mean anything. Yet many people think because it's written down, it's immovable. Because it's written down, it's a fact. The fact is that all prices are arbitrary. Anybody who's in business knows that you set your prices very much in an arbitrary fashion, based on costs, based on anticipated profitability, based on competitive conditions, based on how much the market will bear, and so on. So all prices are arbitrary. That means all prices were made by somebody. That means that all prices can be revised, adjusted, and remade by somebody too. So always remember that even written prices are not valid. So if you develop the attitude that no matter what the price is, you can improve the deal in some way, this is your key. Always be looking for ways to improve the deal in your behalf, to get it cheaper, to get it faster, to pay less, to get more thrown in, and so on. And the key method is this. To be a successful negotiator, the key method is to ask. Ask for what you want. Ask honestly. Ask ingenuously, adamantly. Ask any way you like, but ask for a better deal. Ask for them to improve the offering. Ask and say why, and say why not. Now, there's a reason why people don't ask. Critical reason, and almost invariably, it's what goes back to our great bugaboo, the fear of rejection. The fear of rejection starts off in early childhood, and the fear of rejection is the fear of hearing the words no. As a matter of fact, we will often accept agreements and deals that are far less than we could get because we're afraid of asking for something better because we're afraid somebody will say no. And there's only one way to get over the fear of rejection with regard to negotiating. It's simply this, is to ask over and over again until you no longer fear or are worried about what anybody says. Psychologists call this the process of systematic desensitization. If you always ask for a better deal in your own behalf, if you always look at everything as being capable of being negotiated, eventually, no matter how many times people say no to you, it'll get to the point where it rolls off your back and you realize that a no is not personal, that a no doesn't mean anything. So always ask. It never hurts you to ask. And I have spoken to thousands of people in my negotiating seminars, and I've had experiences of my own where you ask for sometimes things that are ridiculous, and they say, okay, and they give it to you, and you say, that's amazing, and you wonder how much more you could have gotten. Negotiating is all a game. It's all a game. This is a perfect thing to remember in the back of your mind. It's all just a game. It's not real. It is not the most serious thing in life. Negotiating is a game. Some people look upon negotiating as the great game of life, and they insist upon negotiating even if there is improvement possible. They just like to haggle. They like to bargain. They like to negotiate because it's part of a game. It's fun to them. And if you look upon negotiating as fun, then you'll look for opportunities to engage in it whenever you can. And I'll show you as we go through the things you can do or not do to make it a game that you win more often than not. All right, here is point number two. This is the purpose of negotiating, or the aim of negotiating. And I want to read this because I think it's absolutely excellent. It says, the purpose of negotiating is to reach an agreement. Okay? The purpose is to reach an agreement. It's not just simply to negotiate, but it's somehow to get to an agreement. To reach an agreement wherein all parties are satisfied. And they are satisfied to the extent that their needs are met. They feel that they have come out well in a negotiation. A good deal is a deal that both people feel that they're better off as a result of having entered into. And if their needs are met, they are impelled, and this is it, they are internally motivated to fulfill their commitments. A good deal is one where the person is happy enough about having entered into the deal that they want to go through with it and they want to fulfill their commitments. A bad deal is one that once a person is in the deal, they feel uneasy about the deal and they do everything possible not to fulfill their commitments. And finally, a good deal is one where parties want to fulfill their commitments and enter into additional deals, enter into additional negotiations and transactions. So if you look upon negotiations from this point of view, you realize that negotiation is something that has a beginning, a middle, and it has no end because it goes on continuously. When you enter into negotiations, look upon it as part of establishing relationships. Some of the best business relationships that you or I will ever have begin with a negotiation that works out satisfactorily, where both parties are happy, they're satisfied, they're fulfilled, and it goes on for years. So be alert to that. The worst type of negotiation is one where when it ends, neither party wants to negotiate again, and neither party feels comfortable, or one party does not feel comfortable about fulfilling their commitments. Styles of negotiating. There are several, and there are several results of these styles. The first style, A, is what is called win-lose. Win-lose negotiating is where A gets what he wants, A wins, B loses. Win-lose negotiating, of course, is not the kind of negotiating that leads to additional transactions. B is what you might call the reverse. It's lose-win. Lose-win means that B gets what he wants, B wins, A loses. B's needs are satisfied, A's needs are not satisfied. Or then we have C, which is lose-lose. Lose-lose means the two of them enter into a deal neither of them is satisfied with, neither of their needs are met, both lose. Both are not happy with the deal. This often happens with antagonism, animosity, arguing, quarreling, and so on. Now, D is what we call compromise. A compromise is where some needs are met, but not all of either party. Partially satisfying, partially dissatisfying. It's the best, if you like, of the worst types of deals. The next type is no deal. You present your positions and your needs and your interests, and you find that you cannot come to an agreement, that you're too far apart. And finally, F is what is called win-win. Both parties feel that they win. Both parties feel that they have entered into an excellent deal. Both parties are happy and satisfied and eager to continue, fulfill their commitments, and enter into additional deals. Now, win-win requires, in most cases, coming to what is called the third alternative. Since both people enter into a negotiation with a series of ideas, interests, positions fixed in their minds, win-win means that you negotiate and you look for a third alternative, which in most cases is different from what either party came to the negotiation with, but is more satisfactory to both parties than the original positions. And this entire course, from everything we talk about for the next few minutes, is going to be based on win-win negotiating. The things that you can do to enter into agreements, to give yourself the strongest position, but to enter into an agreement where both parties feel happy, satisfied, and fulfilled as a result. This brings us to number four. This is called the critical element in negotiating, and it's called power. Power is the critical element in negotiating. The more power you have in a negotiation, the more likely it is that you will end up with a satisfactory result. If a person has a gun and puts it at your head and demands your money, this may not be a very satisfactory negotiation. It may be a win-lose negotiation, but the power is so great that A gets what he or she wants and B gets nothing. Okay, so let's look at some of the elements of power. Power, by the way, is all in perception. It is the perception, not the power itself. One of the most famous stories in military history was the fall of Singapore to the Japanese in World War II. The British Army had over 50,000 troops on Singapore, and they surrendered to a Japanese general who had less than 20,000 men under his command because the British were convinced that the Japanese had over 100,000 men ready to assault the island. And the Japanese were capable of exploiting that perception and were able to bring about a total capitulation, the biggest single defeat and surrender in the history of the British Empire. And there's several ways that you can create the perception. Let's look at them. One of the ways, of course, is by scarcity. If you can create the perception that you have something that the other person needs and you don't have very much of it and other people want it, that gives you tremendous bargaining power. Another is indifference, the perception of whether or not you care whether this person buys it or doesn't buy it or enters into the agreement, especially if the other person wants it. Indifference gives you tremendous power. Indifference, of course, is created by you having lots of options. The more options you have, the greater your indifference. Authority is important, too. The fact that you have the authority to make a decision or not make a decision that will benefit someone else gives you power. And one other point of power is what is called courage, the willingness for you to walk away from a deal, the willingness for you to take a strong position on a deal, the willingness for you to take calculated risks gives you perceived power in the eyes of the other person. A second element of power is the power of commitment. If the other party perceives that you are totally committed to getting the very best deal, that you will do whatever is necessary. In the Singapore example, the British were convinced that the Japanese would overrun the island and kill everybody on it. The Japanese were able to convince the British of this because they had overrun all of Malaysia up to that point. So they could see that this commitment or determination was very, very strong, and it caused them to capitulate in the negotiations because they did not want what would happen as a result. Now, another part of power is the power of expertise. In a negotiation, the person who has the greatest knowledge, the greatest perceived expertise, who can say, this is how and why it should happen because of my knowledge, is a person who has tremendous power. If you're selling a very complex or sophisticated or difficult product or service, a person who has knowledge power has tremendous power in the negotiation. A person who can say that this complexity of factors will bring you what you're looking for, what you want and need, at a price that is satisfactory, that carries a lot of weight to a buyer who does not have the information. Also, you have the power of knowledge of needs, especially knowledge of needs of the other person. For instance, there are many examples, many cases, where in dealing in business, someone will find out that this company has a very pressing need for a product or service, or that this company has serious financial problems and difficulties and needs extensions of credit, or that this company has financial difficulties and needs to make this sale at whatever price. So knowing what the needs of the other person are give you tremendous amount of power. There's another type of power that's important, the power of empathy. It's the power of identification, of establishing a warm relationship with the other person so that the other person feels that you really care about them getting a good deal. Now, this should be genuine. It should be a very honest empathy, and you should sincerely want to make sure that both parties benefit and win from this deal. And if you feel that and you express that, it gives you a lot of power, because people are far more likely to enter into agreements with people they like than people that they don't. The other two types of power are, first of all, the power of rewarding and punishing. If you have the ability to confer rewards, benefits, agreements, royalty agreements, or something on someone, they're far more likely to do business with you. And if you have the ability to punish them financially by withdrawing some reward or some type of remuneration, that will cause them to want to negotiate with you. And finally, the last is the power of investment. The power of investment refers to the amount of time and effort that you and or the other party have spent in this negotiation. If you have only spent 5 minutes, there's very little investment. But if you spent 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months over time trying to work toward an agreement, the more investment that each party has, or the more investment that the other party has, the greater power you have in terms of making it come true. If the other party has, for instance, done extensive market research and spent an enormous amount of money in preparation for this negotiation, they have a lot of investment and you have a lot of power. No one will negotiate with you seriously unless they are convinced that you have the power to help them or to get something that they want, or the power to hurt them and deprive them of something they want in some way. So all serious negotiations begin with a person believing you have some sort of power, authority, and ability to help them get something that they want. So think about that when you go into negotiation. How can you increase your perceived power? One of the things that people do to increase their perceived power is they'll bring an expensive lawyer or an expert to a negotiation in order to answer questions, which causes the other party to say, this person is extremely well prepared and knowledgeable. Okay, here is number five. Number five is emotion. Emotion is a key factor in negotiating. And one of the most important things I can tell you is that the more you can keep your emotions out of the negotiation, the more capable you will be of negotiating and arranging the best deal for yourself and your organization. The more emotional you become, the less capable you are of performing and acting in your own best behalf. Now, what are the most dangerous emotions? Well, the most dangerous emotions are greed. Greed is an emotion that very often backfires, and that you can get into an agreement on the basis of greed that will turn out to be to your detriment. Or fear. Fear is another emotion. You have to be aware of what you're feeling and thinking in a situation like this. And the third is anger. The triggering greed, fear, and anger is often used by manipulative negotiators to get people overwrought. Because when you become emotional, your ability to make proper evaluations is distorted considerably. But the best and most important of all emotions is desire. And I'll talk about desire here, because desire is a key factor in determining the course of negotiating. First of all, with regard to desires, ask yourself this: how badly do you want it? You see, how badly you want it and how badly you express that you want it determines how much power, how much ability you have to negotiate successfully. If you really want something so badly that you can taste it, you're going to pay almost anything. If the other person knows that, they are going to be able to get that out of you. So you have to ask yourself, B, what's the worst possible outcome? In order to get yourself to the point where you're unemotional, what's the worst possible outcome? What would happen if you didn't get it at all? And prepare your mind for not getting it. Prepare your mind for the worst possible outcome. What if you didn't get it? Would it kill you? Would it end your life? Not at all. And do whatever you possibly can to lower the amount of desire that you have. Be willing to let it pass if you like. The third question is to ask yourself, so what? If the deal collapses, if it doesn't work out, so what? I used to work with a very successful businessman, and when I'd get very excited about a deal, he'd say, Brian, deals are like buses. There'll always be another one along. Don't get excited. Don't worry about this. If it doesn't go together, forget it. Something else will happen. So what you have to do is you have to practice detachment. When you go into a negotiation, watch yourself very carefully. Practice detachment, like the Buddhists do. Don't get involved. Don't get emotionally involved. Don't identify with a negotiation. That's the key to your retaining a position of strength. And this brings us to the next key element in negotiating, which is time. Time and timing. Let me just say two points with regard to time and timing. Is that the key elements in timing are urgency. If there is urgency versus lack of urgency, the person who is most urgent to enter into the agreement has the weaker hand. The person who is less urgent, if you like, or not urgent, has the stronger hand. If you can create urgency by suggesting that the product or service is scarce, that you're running out of it, that the price is going up, and so on, it gives you a position of strength. And the second thing with regard to timing is delay. Remember that, as the Japanese say, delay is the cruelest form of denial. The more you delay a negotiation, the more you delay a resolution for a person who wants to come to some kind of conclusion, the greater strength that you have. And I remember a very common story of a gentleman who went to Japan to negotiate a contract for his company. Very important contract for him. He was a young, upcoming executive. And the Japanese picked him up at the airport, picked him up in a limousine, and drove him to his hotel and said, "We'll take care of everything while you're here in Japan. You are our honored guest. Give us your plane tickets. We'll arrange for your transportation back to the airport," and so on. They took away his plane tickets. They knew exactly how much time he had to make a deal. He had 6 days in Japan, and then he had to leave and get back to the States. What they did is, for the first 5 days, they took him out, they entertained him, they took him to the plant, they wined him, they dined him, but they never discussed business. He was trying to be as polite as possible, and they didn't get down to serious negotiating till the final day. And the final negotiating took place in the car on the way to the airport, and he was danced around and accepted a far worse deal than he ever would have if he realized that they were using timing against him. So here's the final rule with regard to timing. It's the 80-20 rule. The 80-20 rule says that the last 20% of any negotiation will deal with 80% of the important issues and the value of that negotiation. The first 80% only deals with 20%. The last 20% deals with the key issues. So be very alert to that. It's very seldom that you make some kind of great breakthroughs in the first couple of minutes. This brings us to number 7. Key to negotiating is options. And basically, options equal freedom. You are only as free as the options that you develop. In other words, if you go into a negotiation and you have only one choice and it's what the other person has or does not have, your hands are tied. But if you have a variety of options, if you know that you can go a variety of different ways and do a variety of different things, then you have a tremendous amount of strength, power, and bargaining leverage. The key to options is this: the more the better. The more the better. So do your research, get your information, find out where you can get the product or service, how much you'll have to pay for, who else will supply it, what the times and dates and deliveries are. So when you go into a negotiation, you know that you don't have your back against the wall. Again, develop alternatives, develop options. You're only as free as your alternative courses of action. All right, number 8 is know what you want. Know what you want is so important. It's amazing how many people enter into negotiations and they don't know what they want until they get there, or they make it up as they go along. Knowing what you want requires thinking it through in advance. Think it through in advance. Think it through to the point of clarity. And by the way, this means think it through on paper. Write it down. Write down everything that you want. Describe the ideal agreement. What would be your ideal outcome? Think it through. Talk it over with someone else. Discuss it with someone. But find out what would be your ideal outcome. And say, now, if we could have everything that we wanted, if this deal was working absolutely perfectly, what would it be? Now, this doesn't mean that you want to get the product or service for free, or that you want something that's totally to the disadvantage of the other person, but there is an ideal outcome with which you would be satisfied. And this brings us to a very simple equation, which is what we call high, medium, and low. When you go into a bargaining transaction, when you go in to buy or sell something, you should have what we call the best. This is the very best that you could expect. The second, or the medium, is the acceptable. And the third is the worst. If you got driven back to the worst, this is the lowest that you could possibly go. This is what is called your ultimate fallback position. You could fall back to this. You would hate to do it, but that's the lowest that you would go. But below that, you couldn't do anything. So where do you start in a bargaining or a negotiation? Well, you start here. You start and you begin slightly above your very best. Because very often, you will find that you'll begin high, you'll have to make a concession, and you'll end up getting your best deal. But think through, what is the best that you could reasonably ask for? What is an acceptable deal? What is the worst that could happen to you? And have it worked out and think it through on paper before you do it. Remember, the person who is perfectly clear about what they want has a tremendous advantage over the person who is vague or fuzzy. Clarity, clarity, clarity. Key to negotiation. Number 9, this is 80% of all negotiating success is preparation. 80% of your success will be contained in the preparation that you do before you go into the person's office. The key elements that you look at in terms of preparation: subject matter. What are you going to talk about? What is the purpose of the meeting? What is the purpose of the negotiation? Define it clearly. What are you going to include in the negotiation? What are you going to exclude from the negotiation? And objectives. What are your objectives? What do you want to accomplish?
What do you want to accomplish when you go into this discussion? Are you clear about your goals?
You see, the clearer you are about your goals, the easier it is for you to convey it to them, the easier it is for you to bargain on your own behalf, the easier it is for you to move forward and backward. What are the issues? What are the issues of contention? In other words, what are the areas of conflict or disagreement? What are the things that have to be discussed and resolved?
Where you have one opinion, they may have another. And finally, D is, what are your positions?
What is the starting position? Are you starting off with a desire to enter into a negotiation and they are starting off with no desire at all? Or are you both starting off with a desire to come to some kind of happy compromise?
But find out what your positions are and think these through on paper. Think through in your own mind what's going to happen.
Okay, this brings us to positions. And this is number 10. Now, positions are important. Positions are starting points. Positions include where you're coming from, where you're going, how much and how little you can accept.
Positions refer to, if you like, boundary conditions, the things that must be dealt with, the constraints to the agreement. Let us say that you have this. Here is a position. And here at the top of the position, you have the best possible. Here you have the worst possible. And what you're looking for is something in between. And here you have the minimum and your maximum that you can go in either direction in order to achieve the best and the worst. So think through your position clearly so you know where you're starting. Ask for A, what are your essentials? What must you have as a result of this? What must you have? What must you not have? What are your minimums and maximums? Think that through. And B, what are the others' essentials? What is their minimum? What is their maximum? What must they absolutely have? I negotiated a lease not long ago for some office premises. As I sat down doing my pre-negotiation analysis, and I knew that the owner could only lease the premises under certain terms and conditions and for no less than a certain amount, or the mortgage holder would not approve it. So I knew that the essentials of the other were a specific parameter. Now, times, terms, amount of free rent, parking, and so on, those were things that could be negotiated by the landlord, but the basic rent was controlled by the mortgage holder, and I wanted to stay in that property. So knowing the other's essentials made it possible for me to negotiate a much better lease than if I hadn't thought it through in advance. Also, what are you willing to concede? What are you willing to concede in order to get your essentials? Think of everything that you want and say, what must I have? What do I want to have? What would it be nice to have? And think of what you would concede. And D, with regard to positions, what sort of tie-in concessions do you have? A tie-in concession is you say, all right, he or she is going to ask for this, he or she is going to ask for that. What concessions am I willing to give in order to satisfy them? Make a list. These are my tie-in concessions. Give tie-in concessions very grudgingly. I mean, you don't just throw them all out. When you are negotiating for something that you have to have and they're inflexible, then you can say, look, I'll throw in this if you give me that. Or I'll relent on this point if you'll relent on this point. But think through what you're willing to give up before you go in. Remember, 80% is preparation. This brings us to number 11. It's a very simple principle, and I recommend that you do it. It's called situation reversal. Put yourself in the position of the person you're negotiating with and think through and argue the negotiation from their point of view. Try to see it through their eyes. Assume that the other person is reasonable, that they want to achieve a beneficial transaction for themselves. Write down, if you were in their position, what would be all the things that they would want to get in this negotiation? This is what lawyers do, by the way. They argue the case from the other lawyer's point of view before they prepare their own case. So you argue the negotiation from the other person's point of view before you prepare your own case, and it gives you tremendous clarity in seeing where you have areas of agreement, where you have areas of disagreement, and where you can find areas of compromise very rapidly.
12, assumptions are one of the major reasons for disagreement. Assumptions and incorrect assumptions equal disagreements. And surprisingly enough, much of the time that is spent in negotiations is spent in resolving incorrect assumptions. First of all, ask, what are your assumptions?
Not only your obvious assumptions, but your hidden assumptions.
And B,
what are their obvious and hidden assumptions? What are they assuming when they come in? Are they assuming that you really want to enter into this agreement? Are they assuming that you're indifferent to it? Are they assuming that you're friendly or hostile? Are they assuming that you're a good person or a hard person, and so on? Then question C is, could your assumptions be wrong? This is important. Could your assumptions be wrong based on what you think their assumptions are? If they were, how would you have to change your situation if your assumptions were wrong? See, one of the assumptions that we have when we are entering into a negotiation with someone else is that they actually want to conclude a deal. Sometimes people don't want to conclude a deal with you. What they want to do is they want to negotiate with you to force somebody else. So be very alert to that. And ask yourself, how can you clarify assumptions? Now, there's a simple way to clarify assumptions. And this is how I suggest that you start off every negotiation. It's what is called the interview style. Instead of launching right into business, go into an interview style as though you were a journalist. And here's a question that I ask over and over again to start an interview, to start a negotiation. Tell me, if you would, how would you ideally like to see this discussion resolved? What would be your ideal outcome to this negotiation? If you can tell me exactly what it is that you want to accomplish, then I can tell you exactly what it is that I want to accomplish, and we can start off clearly with regard to our assumptions, our positions, and our interests. And then finally, feedback in your own words. All right, now as I understand it, what you're saying is this. Feedback in your own words. As I understand it, what you want to accomplish is this. Is that correct? And in order of priority, this is what you want to accomplish and so on. Is that correct? And finally, get agreement on your basic boundary conditions. Once you can agree on your basic boundary conditions, you can move right along into agreement on some of the critical issues in the negotiation. Now here's number 13, what we call the law of four. The law of four is a tremendous mental tool. It works almost all the time, and it says there are four main issues to be resolved in any negotiation. There may be many smaller issues, but there are four main issues. Your job is to think through and identify what those issues are. Number one will be the big one, which will probably be finalized in the last 20% of the conversation, and then you'll have number two, three, and four, which have an impact and affect number one. Now, let me give you an example. I bought a car recently, and we had to negotiate the purchase of the car. There were four ingredients in the negotiation. The price was the major ingredient, and then the style and color, delivery date, and then the accessories. Those four issues are resolved every time you buy a car. We finalized numbers two, three, and four. What we wanted in the car, what it would look like, what the accessories would be, when we would take delivery of it. Then we came back to the price and were able to resolve the price. And the whole negotiation flowed. And I'll tell you how we did this a little bit later. This is a very, very powerful technique that you can use. But think through, what are the four issues in any negotiation? And you'll be surprised. Like if you buy a house, what are the issues? Price, occupation, when you take possession of the house, the mortgage financing and the terms, and what is included in the purchase and what is not included in the purchase. So over and over again, you'll find that the law of four is pretty consistent. It may be five, it may be three. Okay, what are the marks of a successful negotiator? Do you want to be a successful negotiator? If you look at successful negotiators, here are some of their characteristics. First is that the negotiator views negotiating as a life process, that all of life is a process of compromising and adjusting conflicting interests. That it goes on every single day from the time you get up in the morning to who's going to make the breakfast, put on the coffee, plug in the kettle, take the kids to school, and so on. It's a continuous life process, but it's a win-win life process if you want to have a happy life. The good negotiator is open-minded. The good negotiator does not have a fixed mind or does not develop rigid positions. The poor negotiator gets one idea in mind, and that's the idea that they fight for, and they have very unhappy lives and very unhappy relationships. Good negotiators, flexible, willing to change, willing to drop a position if new information suggests that it would be a good idea. The good negotiator is cooperative. They don't look upon negotiating as a fight or as an adversarial relationship. They also are creative rather than competitive. Rather than trying to win, they are trying to find a solution that both people will be happy with. And finally, and this is most important, they're non-manipulative. When we talk about negotiating, one of the things that I find that people want to learn is tricks, tactics, ways to deke out the other person, ways to get the advantage, if you like. And I will tell you this, in all my years of negotiating, I have never found that good people, superior people, or good deals or superior deals are entered into as the result of any kind of tricks. I've seen lots of books and courses that tell you how to do role reversals and good guy, bad guy, and manipulative techniques where you try to trick or deke the person psychologically into making commitments or making decisions. This is all BS. It does not work in the real world. In the real world, it is honest, straightforward, direct, sincere men and women with a clear idea of what they want to accomplish and a commitment to entering into an agreement that everybody can live with who are the most successful in negotiating. You do not have to be cunning and difficult in order to be successful as a negotiator. Okay, here are some suggestive elements in negotiating which you should be aware of, because suggestive elements can affect as much as 95% of your thinking. 95% of your feelings, your emotions, your attitudes, your opinions, how you respond in a negotiation can be determined by these if you're not alert to them. And you know what they are. A starting point is location. Location has a powerful effect. Now, if you're going to negotiate something important, the key is to negotiate either on your own turf or on neutral turf. Your own or neutral. Because when you go to somebody else's office, somebody else's company, and you negotiate on their turf, you are at a distinct psychological disadvantage because you are outside your comfort zone. Even if you just take the person out for coffee or for lunch, it's better than negotiating something serious in their office, in their boardroom. All right, number two, or second, is personality. Personality is a powerful suggestive element. Now, what is the best personality in a negotiation? The best personality is an empathetic personality. Empathy, by the way, has been identified as the number one psychological or personality quality of all top salespeople. All people who are the very best at helping people enter into business transactions have very high degrees of empathy. They are liked and respected, and people feel good about them. So the more empathetic you are about the position of the other person, helping the other person get what they want, the more likely it is the person will enter into a successful negotiation with you. And the third is positioning. Positioning or body language. Positioning and body language. Very, very important. You can learn a lot from body language and a lot from positioning. The basic rule with regard to positioning is don't sit across the table from a person that you're negotiating with. Sit corner to corner, or better, sit at a round table, or even better, sit at chairs that don't have anything in between, just a coffee table. Position yourself so that you are in a cooperative position, not in an adversarial position. And with regard to body language, keeping your hands open and on top of your legs, or keeping your arms open and not folded, is a powerful way of suggesting sincerity, honesty, and frankness. When you close your eyes or lean back, what you're suggesting is that I'm closing you out, I am not agreeing with what you're doing, I am entering into a combative or adversarial position with you. So be very aware of positioning and body language. And finally, timing. Timing is important. We talked about that before. There's two types of timing. There's hurried versus relaxed. And you'll find that both of them have their place in negotiating. But if somebody's in a tremendous hurry to make a deal or to come to a conclusion, and you're relaxed, it gives you a psychological advantage. Again, and you are just as relaxed as the options that you have developed. Comfort is another key. The more comfortable you are, that means air conditioning, lighting, rest, not fatigue, good furniture. If you're tired, you'll find that you'll make bad deals. That's why most organizations do not allow their executives to enter into business transactions except for 24 hours after flying across country because of jet lag. You find that because of jet lag, you don't think well. You don't think clearly because your mind and your body are on a different calendar, on a different clock. The more comfortable you can make the people you're negotiating with, the more that they will like you, the more likely you will enter into a good deal. And attitude is very important. A positive attitude, a cheerful attitude, is much more effective in a negotiation than a negative attitude. And the most important part of attitude is patience. Again, the very best negotiators are very patient negotiators. They take their time. They go slowly. They're not in a hurry. They don't rush. They take time to understand the other person. They remain unemotional, except that they are warm, they're supportive, and they try to keep focusing the conversation on understanding and reaching an agreement that is satisfactory and helps the other person. In negotiating, by the way, there's what is called the law of indirect effort. It says the harder you try to achieve your own interests, the less successful you will be. But the harder you work to achieve an agreement that will be satisfactory to the other person, the harder the other person will tend to work to achieve an agreement that is satisfactory to you. The key is that both of you need to know what the other person has to get out of this agreement. All right, this brings us to number 16, which is a method of persuasion. How do you persuade people over to your point of view in the course of a negotiation? And first of all, it's called persuasion
by reciprocation.
The research seems to show that one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, of all persuasive influences on another person is reciprocity. It is what you do for the other person. It is
tit for tat. It is doing favors for the other person that cause the other person to want to do favors or to give things to you. So here are some keys to using this persuasive method of reciprocity. The first is called the Socratic method.
I learned this many years ago, and I thought, why? This is so powerful.
You start off the negotiation or the discussion, especially if there are a whole list of things to discuss, and you go through every single item that you agree on. You agree, first of all, on everything that you agree on.
And you will find that no matter how far apart you are, there are a tremendous number of issues upon which you agree or have thoughts in common. Once you've agreed to all of these, it's like yes. It's like having the person say yes, 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 yes.
We agree on this, we agree on that, agree on all the minor issues. Before you get to more difficult issues, both people's minds are now open, flexible, friendly, warm, adaptive, and much more likely to come to an acceptable conclusion. Here's a little sentence that I would like you to memorize for the rest of your negotiating life, especially when you're negotiating agreements.
It's, let's come back to that. Let's come back to that. Whenever you're negotiating, especially in the first 80% of the time allocated,
and you run into a sticking point where one or the other is sticking on this point, say, let's come back to that. Let's go on to the other things. We'll come back to that later. And just go right past it, because the longer you hang on a point where one person or the other feels very intense, the more likely it is you will poison the negotiating climate and make agreement on the other issues, which may be minor, even more difficult. So let's come back to it. Just pass it over and get through everything that you possibly can that you can agree on.
Agree slowly. I mean, don't just agree. Agree slowly and aim for fairness. Fairness is one of the most important single things that you can bring to an agreement. There is nothing that causes people to become angrier and more defensive than to feel that you are not being fair, and there's nothing that causes people to be more cooperative than to feel that you are bending over backwards to be fair to them and to their interests. So the fourth part of this is tit for tat. Every single time that you give in on one of their issues, you are putting money in the bank in terms of coming to a satisfactory conclusion on your major issues later on. So if you like, be a go-giver in the first part of the negotiation. Find every single way that you possibly can to cooperate and to work cooperatively with the other person, and you will build up a bigger and bigger propensity for them to want to do something for you later on. And later on you can say, look, we've given away all of these points, we've done all the giving up to now, all we're asking is that you concede to us a little bit in these areas, which of course are the critical areas. I remember once I negotiated a development agreement with a town. The critical element of the development agreement was off-site levies, which ran into about $400,000 or $500,000. We, the developers, did not want to have to put them up in front. They, the town, wanted the off-site levies to offset the cost of servicing the development. The critical point that I had in my mind is that we would agree and negotiate on what they should be, but what I wanted, once we'd agreed, is that we would not have to pay them until the lots were actually sold and we could pay them out of the sales price of the lots. And we spent the entire day giving up everything except we agreed on their price, which was the amount they charged, but they agreed on our terms that it would be paid after we'd sold the lots rather than before, and it was the most critical single element of the agreement. Remember, price and terms are very different. You can agree to a price that may be more than you want to pay as long as you can get terms that are favorable. So if you concede on the price, they should concede on the terms, and vice versa. Be very alert to that. Gerald Nuremberg has a beautiful example. He says, this pen for $1,000. You as the negotiator say, yes, I'll pay you $1,000 for that pen. The terms of payment will be this. Every time I meet you in the Milwaukee airport at 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, I will give you $1 until the entire $1,000 is paid off. You see, if you can name the terms, then the price can be anything that you like. I had some friends who were negotiating some years ago. People wanted $1 million for the land. It wasn't worth more than $600,000 or $700,000. But they wanted $1 million. Why? It's because somebody that they knew had got $1 million for their land. And they finally agreed to pay them $1 million, but they agreed to pay it over 20 years with no interest. So it worked out to be less than $1 million, but they got the price, they named the terms. Okay, persuasion by social proof. This is another powerful way to get people to accept your arguments about what is fair and what is reasonable in the agreement. A is to use facts, statistics, names, numbers,
proof, evidence from people that the people know about or have heard about who have already entered into this agreement.
Using facts that confirm that this is a reasonable agreement and these are reasonable terms and referring to people who have already done it is a tremendous tactic and extremely helpful in making sales. And also similar others in similar situations. If you can refer to people who are very much like the person you're negotiating with, who have entered into similar agreements under similar situations, under similar stresses, it's very likely that this will be a very, very powerful persuader. We are inordinately persuaded to do things that we think other people have done whose opinions we respect. If you're a doctor and you say that several doctors have already bought this computer at this price and these terms, the tendency for the doctor to enter into the agreement is far greater than if you say that you're the first doctor. Now, number 18 is price negotiating tactics. Okay, price tactics. Just 7 simple price tactics that you should use whenever you're buying anything that has an arbitrary price, from a package of chewing gum on up. The first is what is called the flinch. No matter what the price is, flinch and say, geez, that's expensive. Boy, that's a lot. Sometimes just flinching will cause the person to come down in price. B is just the question. You say, is that the best you can do? Is that the very best you can do? Very often, just asking that and remaining perfectly silent will cause the person to say, well, we could probably get it down and so on. And we could probably, we could probably chop something off of that. Well, what is the best you could do? And you keep asking, what is the best that you could do? What is the best that you could do? And surprisingly enough, they don't know if you've ever spoken to anybody else who's gotten a good deal from them, and they become very uneasy. And sometimes a question that I ask is, are you telling me you've never sold it for less than that to anybody else? And then nobody's ever bought it cheaper than that? Here's what you can say. I can get it cheaper elsewhere. I can get it cheaper. This demolishes a lot of price resistance. I can get it cheaper somewhere else. I can go somewhere else to get it. Very often they say, wait a second. Let's talk about this seriously. D is lowball. When they're asking you for $100, say, I'll give you $50. Sometimes they'll say, well, how about $60? Very often you find if you lowball and offer a price that is ridiculous, sometimes they will sell it to you for far less than you'd ever thought you were going to have to pay. E is to add what is called the nibble. And the nibble is the add-on. You say, okay, I'll agree to this price once you've wrapped it up and written it up, of course, but you'll throw in free delivery, won't you? And they say, if you don't throw in free delivery, I don't want the deal. Once you put the deal together, you see, you can nibble or add on or put a few little things on top of it. They'll say, well, rather than lose the deal, they'll throw it into it. Very, very straight tactics. Number 19 is one of my favorites. It's called the walk-away method. Now, the walk-away method is what I use most of the time. It's what I prefer that people use with me. It's simply this. You say to the person, you say, look, I don't want to quibble with you. You tell me what your very best price is, and I'll tell you whether or not I can meet it. If I can't meet it, I'll tell you, and that will be the end of it, and then you'll walk away. Or I often say to a person when I'm trying to buy something, I say, you tell me what your walk-away price is. In other words, you tell me the price below which you will not sell it. You tell me your final price, and if I can match it, we can discuss it. If I can't match it, then I'll walk away and we'll forget it. Very often, this gets you right straight down to the price that you end up buying it at. I prefer not to quibble. I prefer the walk-away price, and I bought houses like this, I bought cars like this, and I enter into almost all of my agreements by saying, this is the least amount that I'll accept for it, or this is the most that I will pay for it. And it's amazing how that clears people's minds, and you get a yes or a no very fast. But of course, you can always go back, and you can always go back and say, well, I can pay a little bit more, or I can charge a little bit less. Okay, number 20, what they call the Harvard Negotiating Project came up with 4 key elements to successful negotiating. I think this is a very important project. I think you should read the book called Getting to Yes, How to Negotiate. It has 4 things. It says, first of all, 4 elements are people. Separate the people from the problem. Separate the people so that the negotiation does not focus on personalities, but focuses clearly on the issues and on the negotiations. The second part is identify interests before you take positions. Identify interests. In other words, what are the needs of the different parties? Before you write down a list of what you want, write down a list of what you're trying to accomplish. What is the outcome intended to accomplish? The next is options. Develop options before you begin negotiating. What are all the different ways? And you can use brainstorming, you can use mindstorming, you can use a whiteboard, you can use a flip chart. But what are all the different ways that you could satisfy the interests and needs? And D is what they call criteria or boundary conditions. How are we going to decide whether or not we've come up with a good deal? And then what you do is you test the options that you've developed against the boundary conditions. Now, a good deal will satisfy this. It will give us that. It will achieve this. This will be what a good deal looks like for you. This will be what a good deal looks like for us.
And then you go through and you discuss. And you discuss various ways that you can achieve the interests and the needs, that you can fulfill the objective criteria that you've established. Very powerful way of negotiating that keeps people's minds focused solely on the negotiation and keeps it off of the personalities and off of tangential issues. And finally, number 21. Remember that no negotiation is ever final. That no negotiation ends the transaction. That if you get new information that changes your perspective on the situation, go back and ask to reopen the negotiation. I can give you many examples of this. I have some very good friends who ran into financial difficulties on a building. They had to go back to the bank and renegotiate the entire financial package. Now, when you go back to renegotiate, you have to have something to offer. Nobody is going to renegotiate an agreement unless they somehow have a benefit or an advantage. So think through, what is the benefit or advantage for the other person to reopen negotiations and change the terms and conditions? And write down a list of all the benefits and sell your renegotiation on the basis of the benefits. In this case, their benefit was this. If we renegotiate this package, your position will be protected and you'll get your money. If we don't, we'll let the building go bankrupt and you'll lose all of your investment in it. Now, that made a lot of sense to the bank, and they were willing to be very, very flexible to stop from losing their investment and losing their heads. And let me summarize. Four keys to negotiating. These are the big four. Never forget them. If you remember these four keys, you will become and will remain an excellent negotiator. A, number one, is get the facts. Prepare in advance. The power is on the side of the person with the most facts, the most knowledge, the most information, the most options, the most alternatives, the most knowledge about the other person, and so on. Prepare in advance. Get the facts. Number two is ask for what you want. Ask your way to success. Ask for what you want. Say, as we get into this, I want you to know that this is what we would really like to come out of it with. And don't be afraid to ask for a lot going into a negotiation on price, because price is very arbitrary. The third is to seek win-win solutions. Don't seek to win. Don't seek to manipulate. Don't seek to find yourself with an agreement that is to the detriment of the other person. Because remember, life is very long, and what goes around comes around. And if you enter into a bad agreement today, it's going to come back to haunt you later. And the final key to successful negotiations is this. Practice, practice, practice. Negotiate on every occasion. Negotiate on every opportunity. Negotiate even if it's buying clothes, buying cars, buying furniture, buying refrigerators. Practice, practice, practice. It can save you a lot of money. It can save you a lot of time. It can make you a much more effective person. And it can contribute mightily to the success of your career and business.
You have heard Negotiating Strategies and Tactics, one of the Effective Manager Seminar Series with Brian Tracy.